Welcome to the second edition of the Business of Collaboration podcast. In this podcast, we try and answer the following questions. What is innovation? How do people collaborate and work together? Who is behind the most innovative ideas, technology, and knowledge? We are curious about people. How do they innovate? How do they create a new technology or acquire new knowledge? We give them a voice and a platform to share their stories because they are superheroes.
This is your host, Jara Pascual, founder of NoCo and CollabWith. Today, we have the pleasure to talk to Professor Henry Chesbrough, Faculty Director, Garwood Center for Corporate Innovation at the University of California, Berkeley, Haas School of Business. Also, Maire Technimon, Professor of Open Innovation at Louis University in Rome and founder of the World Open Innovation Conference, and also advisor to the National Innovation Fund of Italy. Professor Henry Chesbrough will be a keynote speaker for the first ISPIN virtual conference on innovating in time of crisis on the 7th to 10th of June 2020. This podcast, Business of Collaboration, is in collaboration with ISPIN and is all about what is the role of the open innovation on the recovery plan, how can we help governments and industry to integrate innovation into the recovery plan, what are the new policies needed for the new economy, new normal, new digital, and new innovation after the COVID-19 crisis? And of course, what is open innovation? Do you want to know? Listen to our podcast with Professor Henry Chesbrough, the father of open innovation. Welcome to the Business of Collaboration podcast, Professor Henry Chesbrough, father of the open innovation.
Thank you very much. Great to be here with you.
Thank you. So the first question is about how is your story? Why did you decide to become a professor after having an industry professional career and an MBA?
Well, it's a good question because when I finished my MBA, I was through with school. I felt like I was in my late 20s and I felt that I had been in school most of my adult life. So I was done. But I went into a company in the hard disk drive industry in Silicon Valley, and it was a startup company named Quantum. And like many startups, the work pace was pretty intense. And the industry grew tremendously. And I felt like I learned and saw a lot in a short period of time. So 10 years later, I was actually seeing that industry was maturing, consolidating, and I became much more interested in what was going to be after this industry for me. And that's how I found my way back to academia. It was actually a professor from Stanford who was on our board, and he is the one who suggested to me about maybe going back and becoming a professor. So without his guidance, I probably wouldn't have done it.
Mm-hmm. And now you are here, and you are now a keynote speaker for the first ISPIN virtual conference on innovating in time of crisis on the 7th to 10th June 2020. What will be your keynote about?
So to me, this shift to a virtual conference is itself a kind of innovation.
Yeah.
And how do we keep our attention over many days when we're all staring at computer screens together?
Yeah.
This is something that we're going to have to figure out as a community. And so it's an experiment. I'm very happy to be a part of the experiment. And I'll be watching closely to see what we all do. In terms of my own keynote, I think I have two messages. One is very much about the crisis, and one is something that I think was true before the crisis and remains true now. The message about the crisis is what open innovation can bring to the crisis and how to recover from the crisis. And what open innovation can bring is speed. We typically think about how expensive something is to innovate. And how is it better to do it ourselves, make, or is it better to go outside or buy, or maybe partner and ally? What we don't often think about is the time involved in that decision. Mm-hmm. And in the time of crisis, time becomes much more critical.
Yeah.
And open innovation has many benefits in terms of saving time. So that's one of the messages I'll be bringing to the conference. The second message is the one that I think will be true, was true before and will remain true. And that is, we all in the innovation community spend a lot of our time and attention on the new things, the bright, shiny objects, whether it's AI or blockchain or big data or all these new trends. And I'm as guilty of it as anybody else. But what we need to focus on more is, how do we actually get business results from these innovations?
Yes.
And I think there we have to think not just about generating new ideas, but we have to think about disseminating them broadly.
Yeah.
And then we have to think about absorbing them and putting them to work. So this three-part process of generation, dissemination, and absorption will be my second message to the conference.
Yeah, it's a part of the impact.
Yes.
Because it's somehow we forgot in the supply chain, we can say, of innovation. We were focused many years on the front end of innovation, on ideation. And we forgot totally on the practical side of innovation, is bringing value from this creativity, which means having an impact. Someone has a new value, this new thing is using, and it's very helpful for them or for the industry. And we forgot this part as well on the startups. You know, we are measuring only the investment, but we are not measuring the impact of the number of customers, of, you know, the absorption of this new technology the startups are creating into the corporates and the industry.
Well, you're exactly right. An example that may come up in my talk would be artificial intelligence itself.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that there are some companies doing amazing things with AI already. But for every one of those, I think there are dozens of companies who haven't even gotten started, don't even have their data organized in a way that they can train algorithms to do a better job of running and managing their businesses. The OECD had a report last year about the best versus the rest that really pointed out this big chasm between a few leading companies that are doing some very innovative things quite well, but the rest of the industry is just not keeping up. And so this is also, I think, part of the pattern here, that whether it's blockchain or AI or big data, there are a few companies doing great things, and we all find them very interesting. But for most companies, these things haven't yet really been scaled to their needs. And you were mentioning startups. Another one I would say are the SMEs.
Yeah, the small companies.
They provide most of the jobs and most of the growth in jobs over the last 10 or 20 years. What about them? And I think a lot of these bright, shiny objects haven't really made it to SMEs yet.
Yeah. So what is the role of open innovation on the recovery plan? How can we help governments and industry to integrate innovation into the recovery plan? Because this is one of the issues. Like, when you are in a crisis, you have to change the way you are operating and you are working. So how the innovation fits into the recovery plan, how we can help the governments and the industry to integrate innovation, to change the mindset.
Well, that's right. Well, open innovation, I think, can play an important role in two phases of the crisis. The phase that we're just coming out of is the initial trauma of the crisis itself. And in the trauma, a lot of open innovation is helping things like people making their own masks, their own hand sanitizer, physicians modifying ventilators so that they can support more than one patient at a time. All of these are examples of open innovation to deal with the crisis itself. And we're, I think, at a point now where in most of the advanced countries, we're not finished, but we now finally have enough personal protective equipment to deal with it. Now, the next phase is, how do we recover? How do we innovate and grow again? We're not going to go back to where we were 6 or 12 months ago. That's not the path forward. So what we need now are ways of mobilizing the knowledge in our society, not just in the private sector, but in the governmental sector as well, so that we can actually innovate in new ways. There was a very recent development in Italy. This bridge in Genoa had collapsed a couple of years ago, and it was quite scandalous because the bridge was not that old. But to the credit of the city of Genoa, they were able to rebuild the bridge and officially open it last week in less than 2 years' time. And what they did was very innovative, not just in the design and construction of the bridge, but in the review of the public administration as well. They created a single person who had broad powers over all of the review of all the different aspects of the bridge so that everything could be consolidated and examined under one person instead of the turf battles between different parts of the public administration and arguments over whether it should be this or whether it should be that. So I think this is a very underrepresented part of opening up innovation, is the public sector can play a very powerful catalytic role as well. But they have to innovate as well. We need new work processes from them and collaboration between industry and government. And this, I think, is the opportunity we have. Because of the crisis, business as usual is no longer accepted as a valid reason for something to happen. And this means we have a moment where we can agree that we're not going to do business as usual. And so instead, now let's discuss about what would be the right thing to do in these circumstances. So I think that's that spirit can carry us forward.
Yeah, and talking about the public institutions and governments, so they are working on policies. So how they can change the policies to make this recovery plan and to add the innovation part into the process and to help the industry with the policies to make as well this change?
Yes, so I think there's at least a couple of important roles. One is to help provide funding to some of the new areas that are worth exploring. And the government, by making some investments there, they can help steer the private sector into this direction. I've just become an advisor to the Italian National Innovation Fund. And they're creating a $1 billion venture capital fund that will invest alongside, and in some cases ahead of, private investors. And so helping to steer capital to where it's needed is one role. But another important role is that innovation, when it succeeds, when it's disseminated and absorbed, it creates both winners and losers. And we need, as a society in the public sector, to think hard about how do we handle the losers? How do we help them with upskilling and retraining and give them support so that the society shifts, but we don't leave behind a lot of people on the path? So those are at least two very important parts of what the role that the public sector plays really in supporting an innovative society.
At the same time, we saw with this crisis the direct relationship between the healthcare and business and country economy. How will change or impact the current situation to this correlation in the future? What is this intersection with open innovation?
So one thing I'm seeing as we search for an effective vaccine. Mm-hmm. And as we search for treatments to help ease the pain for the people who've contracted the virus, many life science companies are repurposing drugs, meaning drugs that were initially developed for one use are now being tested for these additional different uses. And I think this is a very positive development, not just in the present moment, but more generally. Too many pharmaceutical companies keep too many compounds locked up for too long. And opening up access to these compounds, finding ways to fund testing of these compounds for new uses is, I think, a very positive development out of this crisis, and one that I expect will continue after the crisis.
And here I have one question from the audience. I think it's matching very good now. because we create a campaign, like, you know, open, yes, to ask for questions for the podcast. And it was one about how we can help the experts and the company to have and to become more open during this crisis. When it was in the crisis from 28, it was not so open. So it was the opposite reaction. So how we can help these organizations to be open, as you said, to open the past research or the past products, to look there and say, instead to create something new, maybe we have to look at what we did already. So how to help to these companies to have this mindset of openness and transparency?
People who have deep technical expertise sometimes develop a mindset that's very closed. I am the expert. I have the knowledge, and I'm going to hoard that knowledge, and I'm only going to share it in bits and pieces at times of my choosing. But other deep technical experts have a very different, much more open mindset. Yes, I know a lot, but I want to learn more. I'm actually very curious about new developments in the field and what new perspectives are coming into the field. And in many areas of science, some of the most innovative areas are at the intersections between the different areas of scientific training and disciplines. So these kinds of curious, open-minded people, I think, are really a great source of innovation. And for many deep technical experts, I think companies can help appeal to their curiosity, to being a student always and continuing to learn, even if you've already learned a great deal, and that you will have more impact as a scientist or as an expert if you open up and share your knowledge more broadly than you will if you simply hoard it and keep it to yourself. So this may require some different incentives in the organization, but it also, I think, starts with a different mindset among the technical experts.
Yeah. And maybe I was thinking as well, some kind of policies to have some KPIs for setting the knowledge, you know.
One thing that has been talked about in the academic literature is having prizes for major achievements. So right now we're in a hunt for an effective vaccine for COVID-19. Why not create a prize? Let's say €1 billion to whoever gets that first virus successfully tested and scaled. And this way we encourage the result, not the input, but the result of the process. And notice, by creating a prize, we don't have to give exclusivity to the company so that they charge high prices to the society for the use of the drug. Indeed, for something in a pandemic, we want very, very broad usage. So we want costs to be very, very low so we can get as many people vaccinated as possible as quickly as possible. So something like a prize is actually much more socially beneficial for the society and still creates enough incentive for the companies that they'll do the hard work to try to win the prize. And along with the money, of course, whoever wins the prize gets enormous recognition and improves their brand image and becomes recognized as a leader in the society. And these are also very desirable things that don't raise the cost of vaccinations.
Yeah, and as well, this prize has to be like in collaboration, you know, has not like not only inside the organization, one organization creating the vaccine, but in collaboration with many other organizations. And then all together, if the prize is the best collaboration to have the vaccine.
Well, that's right. And we get back now to dissemination and absorption, because simply coming up with the vaccine in trace amounts and being able to show in a test of 100 people that it works, we still have to get it to 7 billion people around the planet. And that's a massive manufacturing undertaking that, as you point out, is going to require incredible collaboration across countries, across cultures, different methods and approaches. So this is not going to be the activity of one company or one person. It's going to be requiring the participation of many organizations and companies, international groups like the World Health Organization, national governments and their health ministries, private companies and their laboratories, other private companies and their manufacturing facilities, us as individuals as we're recruited to be volunteers for these tests. There's a massive collaboration that's needed here.
Yeah, and now, you have mentioned in your paper, the last one about the crisis, the issue on how to manage your IP, so intellectual property, more openly. And this topic is related to competition collaboration, so the conversation we are having now. And now, due to the COVID-19 crisis, the competitors are transforming on collaborators. So what is the IP? And how industry and academia can collaborate more while keeping the IP? And is it possible to have a healthy collaboration between competitors and academia and industry? So how do you manage this IP?
That's right. And we should be clear that IP does not stand for Internet Protocol. Here it stands for intellectual property.
This podcast is in collaboration with ISPIN, a community of members from research, industry, consulting, and the public sector. Join Collab With at the 2020 ISPIN Innovation Conference and help Europe's leading innovation management community address today's critical challenges of global importance.
So here we're talking about intellectual property. And the there are two countervailing forces as a society we want to think about. One is we want there to be incentives for innovators and entrepreneurs to take risks, to create new things, to invest in new knowledge. And so this is part of the logic of a patent system, is you give somebody the temporary legal right to exclude others from copying you. And that allows you to have the market to yourself for a limited period of time, and your ability to make profits in that market gives you the incentive to take these risks. So that's an important generative force that we want. But there's a second force. We want to disseminate and absorb this broadly. And if you make the patent too strong, the ability of others to do further improvements, make further modifications, becomes smaller and smaller. So if you make the patent too strong at the beginning, you don't get those follow-on improvements. And in many, many technical areas, the first version was not the best.
Yeah.
It was the follow-on versions that really created the benefit for the society. So we want both forces in play. So I would say we want medium strength intellectual property. We want it strong enough that there's an incentive to get going, to get started. But we don't want it to be so strong that it blocks or chokes off all the follow-on activity. When I'm working with companies, I actually encourage them to take their intellectual property and put it into three categories. One category would be the crown jewels, the things that are truly essential and core to their business and are also very valuable. And these patents should be protected closely, which indeed is what most of the larger companies already do. But that leaves two other categories. And here we need different, more open thinking. At the other end would be intellectual property that really it's not worth it to keep it locked up. It would be much better to publish it, to give it to an intellectual commons or an open source project, or just publish it and don't pay the renewal fees anymore to the patent authorities to keep it in force. It would be privately less costly and socially much better for this category to be very, very open. Then that leaves us the final category, which are the pieces of intellectual property that are in the middle. They're not really important enough to be the crown jewels, but they do have some private benefit so that it might be worth keeping some protection. And instead of giving them openly to everybody or locking them up and sharing it with nobody, this middle group is the ones that I would share selectively with partners, people in your value chains. And what you're doing in these is you're trying to improve the performance of your business, perhaps by enabling suppliers to do their jobs better, or perhaps by giving it to your customers, you get better terms from your customer or an improved preferred relationship with your customer. So you still get value from it, but it's not measured just in the dollars and cents from the IP itself, but rather in the context of the overall business. So these are the things that I share with companies when I encourage them to think about their IP in a more open way. It's not all of their IP, but for most companies, they're locking up too much and would actually do better to share more of it.
And what about the IP? So the intellectual property is not about patents, but it's about knowledge.
Sure. So we also have trademarks and copyright, and we also have trade secrets. So those three, along with patents, are the four general types of intellectual property. And they have different uses. The great thing about a trade secret is it never expires. Think of the formula for Coca-Cola. Although it may not be that hard to figure out, they've never published it. And so they have maintained it as a trade secret, which gives them protection indefinitely. Now, to do such a thing, you have to be very closed, not just to outside organizations. You actually have to be very closed inside your own organization as well. Supposedly, there are only 7 people in the world who know the formula for Coca-Cola. So that means out of all the tens of thousands of people that work for Coke, most of them have no idea. So this is only useful for a small portion of what you're doing. Now, when we get to copyright, copyright does not protect the idea itself, but it can protect the expression of an idea. So you introduced me as the father of open innovation. I cannot take out a patent or a copyright on open innovation, but I did write a book in 2003 with that title that was really its first appearance. And so I do have a copyright over that book that came out in 2003. So that's not the same as all of open innovation, but it gives me some credit in that conversation. And then we get to trademarks. And trademarks are useful when you're trying to sell things and keep clear what's yours versus not yours. So in luxury goods, you think about counterfeits versus the actual ones. So when I was in China many years ago, I was able to buy a Rolex watch for $10, but it turns out it wasn't a real Rolex watch. And after about a week, it stopped working. So trademarks would be the way that you would protect these kinds of things. So the IP has many parts to it, it can get very technical and complicated. But as a society, I think we can come back to where we started. We do want protection for people's ideas, enough to stimulate them to be innovative, but we don't want to turn them into monopolists for a long period of time. We want healthy competition to stimulate the development and growth, not just of one idea or one technology, but many ideas, many technologies.
We are now entering into a new era. So with a new digital approach, new innovation, where it's clear we are going to more innovation for good, tech for good. How do you see the future during and after the COVID-19 crisis?
So these are areas where I think to take ventilators. Medtronic actually published its technical drawings for its ventilators and encouraged others to make their own off of these designs and promised not to enforce any of its intellectual property over its ventilators. So this to me is a very pro-social, pro-innovative response to the crisis. Medtronic can't make all the ventilators itself in the time that they're needed. So by opening up, others can move in parallel.
Yeah.
And technologies like 3D printing really help enable this as well. So this is a good example. And these nonprofit organizations, I think, are helping to stimulate us to think more broadly and more creatively about how we can open up these things more and get the knowledge and ideas and technologies where they're most needed as quickly as possible. Yeah. So all of this, I think, is quite healthy. And I think for many companies, they can work with these nonprofit organizations to stimulate their own internal organizations. Many of our students that I teach are very interested in these kinds of developments, and they want to work at companies that care about these things and that allow these things to happen. So you get a business case for attracting better talent. You get a business case for retaining the talent that you have. You instill a sense of purpose in your organizations that is also very healthy and positive for employee satisfaction, employee engagement. So there are many subtle benefits to doing this kind of activity that I think companies are more and more coming to embrace.
So you are the father of open innovation concept and movement. What is open innovation?
So Eskimos have more than 60 words for snow. And in the innovation community, there are now many definitions of open innovation. And this is, I think, an inevitable result of a concept that has grown enormously since the book I wrote back in 2003. So I have actually lost control over the definition of open innovation. So I'm going to tell you mine, but I must also acknowledge that there are many other definitions like words for snow. I define open innovation as purposive flows of knowledge across organizational boundaries for both monetary and non-monetary purposes that are aligned with your business model. So that's my definition, and it builds off of the economics of research and development. It brings spillovers into the conversation, because instead of unmanaged spillovers, we now have managed flows of knowledge, both into the organization from the outside or outside in, but also the other direction, from the inside of the organization out to others, including other business models. So that's the outside in and inside out parts of open innovation. I would say the outside-in part of open innovation is widely practiced and widely studied, while the inside-out part of open innovation is less practiced and less studied, and therefore may offer more opportunity because it's not quite so congested right now.
Mm-hmm. So, and this is now the question coming from the audience. How did you get to this conclusion?
So when I was a professor at Harvard Business School, I was writing a series of case studies on different high technology companies, most of them in Silicon Valley. This included IBM, Intel, Lucent, Xerox and Xerox PARC, and some pharmaceutical companies as well. And as I looked across these different examples, I was trying to understand what do they have in common. And what I was seeing was a pattern of openness. And the ones that were growing and thriving were being much more open than the ones that were being more traditional. And I didn't think of this initially, but after I looked at the different case studies and I began to see this pattern, that's when I got very excited. And that's when the term open innovation really came to the fore.
So now I will ask you one of the always questions we ask to everyone we are doing the interview for the podcast. What is innovation?
So to me, innovation has two components to it. There's an invention part to it, which is the discovery of new knowledge. And then there's a commercialization part of it, where this new knowledge is taken to the market. Yeah. And we sometimes forget that customers innovate as well. So it's quite often the case that the initial idea, by the time it gets into the market, may actually be transformed in the act of customers not only buying the innovation, but then putting it to work themselves. Part of the absorption aspect we were talking about earlier in the podcast. So invention plus commercialization is my rough definition of innovation.
And then now is, what is collaboration for innovation?
So I think of collaboration as sharing knowledge and perhaps discovering together. Mm-hmm. So it isn't only that you tell me what you think, I tell you what I think, but that together, when we see these things together, we get some new insight, some new sense of possibility that wasn't there before. And so one of the, we were talking earlier about IP, one of the challenges with open innovation in IP is when you and I collaborate and we're in different organizations and we're stimulating each other and we're encouraging each other and we end up with something really good, then we want to say, well, where did it come from? Who owns it? Who deserves credit for it? In a really good interactive collaboration, this can be quite difficult to figure out. So most companies and collaborations have these yours, mine, and ours approaches, where you keep your intellectual property, I keep mine as we go into the collaboration, but what comes out of it, we share in some way that we specify in advance. So we don't necessarily have to unravel the wonderful serendipity of what we created together.
You are listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast, a production from CollabWith and the NoCo community. We are an online community helping businesses connect with experts to solve innovation challenges and create consortiums. We do this through a custom-built environment where academics, startups, and businesses collaborate to innovate and accelerate. Together, we break down the barrier between academics and the business world. Innovation has never been so accessible. And now, back to our podcast.
So now it's about, what is the thing you are most proud of?
Well, I have two wonderful children, but I suspect that's not what you're asking me. I would say in my academic career, the thing that I'm most proud of is the large and growing community of open innovation scholars, really now around the world. We actually have an annual conference called the World Open Innovation Conference, and we gather together more than 200 people from many parts of the world, about two-thirds from academia and one-third from industry, and seeing this community come together is really exciting, and it's something I'm very proud of.
I think, like, I mentioned before, Ukraine is not only a concept, it's a movement. And maybe that's well, for another...
It has become that.
Yeah.
It was not a movement in the beginning. lots of new books are written every year, yeah. And most books are quickly forgotten. And it's a great pleasure that it's now 17 years after the first book was written, that it hasn't been forgotten and that this movement has grown up around it. That's exciting.
Yeah, totally. So maybe for another podcast is to analyze how you created this movement or how it was, you know, the trigger to create the tipping point. That could be a very nice research as well.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I think so. So, and the failure you were learning the most from?
Well, let's see. One failure is that I was not promoted at Harvard Business School. So I got kicked out. And I had to leave Harvard. And this was a very surprising discovery. The signals I had been given were very positive. But the decision was made and I had to leave. So that was a very powerful moment and a very difficult moment for me. And what it caused me to do was to write the book, Open Innovation. And that gave rise to all these other things that have grown out of that. But I think if I had stayed, if I'd been promoted, I had already been publishing some academic articles, and a few of them were getting some attention, but I'm not sure I would have written Open Innovation. And so that's an example of a learning from a failure that turned out pretty well.
Yeah, from a crisis, you know, like every crisis.
It was a crisis, yes.
You know? It's an opportunity.
Yes.
Very good point. So here is now very quick personal questions. So what is your favorite place for holidays?
So let's see. My wife and I have a cabin up in the mountains in the Sierras in California, and we enjoy that very much. So that's one. I also have a part-time position in Rome at a university called Lewis, and I've really gotten to know Rome and enjoy that. And a third city I've spent a lot of time in, and my wife and I both enjoy, is Barcelona. So those three places are a good starting point.
How did your mornings look like?
Most mornings start with me making tea for my wife and me. And we'll see, just discuss how we slept, what does the day look like for each other, what are the things that we need to be aware of with each other. Then I often will make breakfast for us. But on days like today, where I have a podcast, we didn't do the breakfast. So that's how the mornings get started, is it starts with my wife and then it branches out from there.
What are you doing with your spare time on weekends?
So let's see, right now we're living with our two adult daughters who are all sheltering in place with us. So on the weekends, we do things as a family. In particular, we've been cooking a lot. Each of my daughters have some specialties that they're very good at. And so depending on the day and the meal, one or the other of them is the head chef. And then I become the sous chef to support them. And I'm usually the lead on the dishes and the pots and pans afterward.
We were talking about your book, but what is the book are you reading now?
So I just finished a work of fiction called The Mirror and the Light by Hilary Mantel. She is the author who won the Booker Prize Awards for Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. It's a trilogy about Thomas Cromwell in England in the 16th century. And so it's very well done, and it really gives you a sense of the times and some of the organizational issues of running a government, running a country, trying to stimulate an economy, even bringing innovation into the country and the economy. So I just finished that. It was 800 pages, and but I really enjoyed reading it. And so that's a book I've just finished. I also enjoy biographies of Leonardo da Vinci or Benjamin Franklin, Elon Musk, things that give me a perspective over the arc of a person's life. I also enjoy a great deal.
So I know you are listening podcast, at least you were listening some of the episodes about business of collaboration. What is the person I have to interview for this podcast?
Oh, so who should you interview next?
Yeah.
Oh, very nice. Well, I'm looking forward to a discussion in June with Astro Teller, who is the head of Google X. Oh. And Google X is really the moonshot area for Alphabet, the parent company of Google. And I think this area of moonshots is a very interesting, exciting area where some new things are happening. So that would be a great suggestion for you in terms of an area to look at. And in Europe, there's a person named Pablo Rodriguez from Telefonica, who until recently was the head of Telefonica's Project Alpha, which was Telefonica's moonshot organization. And so he too, I think, would be fascinating to talk to about moonshots.
Interesting. Thank you very much. So thank you, Professor Henry.
Sure, thank you very much. And thanks to your audience for their questions. We have, as a skilled interviewer, you have your own questions, but you opened up to take questions from others as well. Mm-hmm. This would be outside in open innovation.
Exactly, thank you. So we have more than 20 questions extra, but I think we have no more time. So maybe we
can. Thank you very much. I enjoyed the chance to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review over on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. You can find a summary of this podcast at podcast.collabweb.org. See you next week.